Appreciate again the messages that are always prepared, and being able to think about that, try to relate so much to that sometimes, because we're getting our foundations rocked in a sense, aren't we? And there's more to come, by the way. I didn't realize sometimes in the engineering aspect some of the things. I didn't know about the wind. I know the wind effects, but I didn't know how much of an impact that went into sometimes the structure and building it, and take that into consideration. I know Mr. Dean does a lot of things that go into people building their homes in the side of a mountain. That's a whole other area right there. And the seismic, I believe the church is getting the seismic stuff right now. But again, there is more to come. Our attitudes are really tested sometimes, and I'll go back to this because even in singing, I wanted to always remember this as we get our foundation shaking and our attitudes tested throughout the week. What's going on in our government is sometimes so difficult to take and to handle when you see the lying and the hatred that's out there. Sometimes I think it's more than we want to go up and shake somebody. It's just very difficult to watch the things that are in our country, the insanity that's there. And it does affect us sometimes, but we're able to look and see so many wrong things that are being done that sometimes that will take our focus off of us, that we really don't deserve to be here. So it's easy to fall into sometimes the right attitude. And I noticed as we sung hymn 48 today, it says, "For a broken spirit is to God a sacrifice, and a broken, contrite heart you will not despise." Those are the hearts that God needs to see, not the proud ones that think that maybe we're so better than somebody else or so much more righteous, especially when we see all the things that are being done that are wrong before us. There's no doubt that we do judgments according to God's law, and there's nothing wrong with that. We just have to make sure we don't fall into the wrong attitudes. And I'd like to start actually by going back to a couple chapters that are mind-blowing. It's, in a sense, it's hard to read these, but they're here for testimonies. Let's go back to Judges chapter 19 and see an incident that took place that's almost hard, especially for some of the women, to see what took place back here and how women were treated. I can't understand when this all happened, when women were treated like a piece of property. It's really hard to focus and see what that happened, because I know from the very beginning that God called the woman a helpmeet, not a slave or not a servant. So how this all took place when men started thinking that it was okay to have more than one wife, very interesting. So many negative things that were taking place on how women became treated in a sense like property in a way. Let's look at Judges 19. Verse 1, "It came to pass in those days that when there was no king in Israel," so this was a difficult time, don't forget, in this time there was no king, and you'll see how this will end and what took place, when there is no good leadership that takes place. So there's no king, that there was a certain Levite sojourning in the remote mountains of Ephraim. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. But his concubine played the harlot against him and went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah and was there for 4 whole months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back, having a servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now it seems here that this man treated her pretty good. In fact, so good that after being back, maybe she spoke about him, but the father goes, "Hey, I like this guy. You know, he seems to be a nice guy." In fact, so much that he stayed more than he wanted to. Verse 4, the father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. And it came to pass on the fourth day that they arose early in the morning, and he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh your heart with a morsel of bread, and afterward go your way." So they sat down, and the two of them ate and drank together. Then the young woman's father said to the man, "Please be content to stay all night, and let your heart be merry." Maybe he was thirsty for fellowship. Who knows? But he wanted him to keep staying. When the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. Then he arose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart. But the young woman's father said, "Please refresh your heart." So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. And when the man stood apart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said, "Look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow, go your way early so that you may get home." But the man was not willing to spend the night. He goes, "Okay, that's enough of the eating and drinking, and we need to go." So that's where this is right here. His father-in-law, he rose early on the fifth day to depart. Verse 9, and when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, "Look, the day is now drawing toward evening. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here that your heart may merry. Tomorrow, go your way early so that you may get home." But the man was not willing to spend that night. So he rose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. With him were the two saddle donkeys. His concubine was also with him. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, "Come, please, let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and lodge here." But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah." So obviously, Jerusalem wasn't a city of the Israelites at that time, still occupied with what we call the Jebusites. He said to his servant, "Let's spend a night either in Gibeah or Ramah." And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go into the lodge in Gibeah, and when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. That was obviously, again, so different from what we have now. Nobody would do that in the houses where we have in the city, that you would take in some kind of stranger. At that time, they would be recognized by someone as, "You're not a foreigner," or there would be a lot more hospitality that would be done at that time. But it was still taken care of. Just then, an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. He was sojourning in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. So it was a Benjamite territory there. When he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Well, where are you going, and where do you come from?" He said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem and Judah toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem and Judah, and now I am going to the house of the Lord. But there is no one who will take me into his house. Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for myself, for your maidservant, and for the young man who is with your servant, there is no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Well, peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only don't spend the night in the open square." So he brought him into his house, gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet, and they ate and drank. Now as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door, then spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, that we may know him carnally." Now, does this remind you of something? Remember the time in Sodom when Lot went through the same thing? So he had these perverted men. The man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come to my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out, humble them, and do with them as you please, but to this man do not such a vile thing." Again, this is recorded. How in the world would somebody do that? I couldn't even fathom that. By the way, keep the men safe, but do with the women what you want to do. So you can see, again, at this time, something happened that there was less value on a woman. I think that certainly could be appreciated of what God says and how God would treat people. But again, there's going to be an answer why things like this took place as we look forward here. The man would not heed him, so the man took his concubine, brought her out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. The woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light. And when her master arose in the morning and opened up the house and went out to his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of his house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, "Get up and let us be going," but there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. So she obviously had died. This is absolutely an awful thing to do. And I wonder if the father-in-law had known what this man had done, if there had been the partying that took place before. But again, it was such a different culture at that time and so different. Again, there's a reason for this. When he entered into his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and dismembered her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And so it was that all who saw it says, "No such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." Very sad thing, a very awful thing, and a really unusual, almost perverted thing to do. How some could even do that, cut up a body into 12 pieces, but it made the impact that he desired that it would make. Chapter 20, "Then all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba as well as the land of Gilead, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Lord at Mizpah. And all the leaders of the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. And then the children of Israel said, 'Tell us, how did this wicked deed happen?' So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, 'My concubine and I went to Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now.'" Verse 7, you can count right here. There was a lot of anger, and people were ticked. See what happens. All the people arose, verse 8. There's one man saying, "None of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us turn back to his house. But now this is the thing we'll do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, 1,000 out of every 10,000, to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, that they may repay all the vileness that they have done in Israel." So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. Now you would think that that would be okay. The testimony shows that it wasn't such a good idea. There was a problem here. "Then the tribes of Israel," verse 12, "sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, 'What is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel.' But the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel." Maybe it was, "Who do you think you are to tell us what to do? We can take care of our own matters." "Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel." Now you've got civil war that broke out because of something that took place. It was an awful thing, no doubt about it, but now it gets even worse. "From their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men among all this people. There were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. And besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men in war." Now, if you take verse 17, and you take verse 15, the odds against Benjamin don't look very good, do they? When you're talking 400,000 against 26,000. Interesting setup that we've got here. Even though, again, there were 700 select men, it speaks about two. "So the children of Israel arose and went up to the house of God to ask counsel of God, 'Which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin?' And the Lord said, 'Judah shall go first.'" Now, when you come right now to verse 18, you might think that things are going well. It was an awful thing to take place. But verse 18 is where the problem starts. And we'll speak more about this. So they just ask, who goes up? What do you think they should have said? It's going to tell you a little bit later. So the children of Israel rose in the morning and camped against Gibeah. And the men of Israel went up to battle against Benjamin. And the men of Israel put themselves in battle array to fight against them. And the children of Benjamin came out of Gibeah and on that day cut down to the ground 22,000 men of Israel. 22,000. Almost as many as they had. Benjamin had 26. They killed 22,000 of the Israelites. Now, you'd probably be asking the question right now, well, that was such a wrong thing to do. Why didn't God bless it? What happened? How do you go against it and you're going against a vile thing that took place to get justice? And yet you lose 22,000. Verse 22, and the people, that is, the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves and array on the first day. Then the children of Israel went up and they wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I again draw near for my battle against the children of brother Benjamin? A little bit different now, isn't it? A little bit different of a statement. They wept before the Lord until evening and asked counsel of the Lord, saying, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? A little bit different. And the Lord said, go up against him. So again, the children of Israel approached the children of Benjamin on the second day. And Benjamin went out against them from Gibeah on the second day and cut down to the ground 18,000 more of the children of Israel. All of these drew the sword. Then all the children of Israel, that is, all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. And they sat there before the Lord and fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. So the children of Israel inquired of the Lord. The Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before in those days, saying, shall I yet go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease? And the Lord said, go up, and for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. Do you get the picture here on what's taking place in each of the situations that happen? Sometimes people can determine that something is so wrong. But then God says, you know, I've not relinquished my power or control, nor the way I work. And you'll see, if they would have had this attitude from the first time, and that's why I said when we just sang the song, after going through an entire week of looking and seeing what's happening in this society and what's happening in this world, we might get into the attitude, you know something, this is so wrong. And I tell you what I'd like to do to some of these politicians. I'd like to do this, and I'd like to do this. And maybe God looks at us and goes, who do you think you are? You know, where were you when I did this, as he said before Job? Gives us an entire different perspective. And I'm not saying that we can't, again, look at what God's laws are, seeing what's happening nowadays and saying, you know, that's so wrong. These things are so wrong, but they've always been wrong from the very beginning. And God says, I've never relinquished my control on what I'm doing and how I'm working. And how I'm working with families and what else I'm doing in the lives of different people. But it shows an entire different attitude. And once again, we can look at this. It was absolutely heinous. You could have said, well, they were justified in doing that. And God says, they're not justified in doing anything. Because they didn't seek me as they should have. With the attitude of fasting, look at how different the attitudes, they fasted until evening. They offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And they went to the priest, as they should have from the very beginning. Verse 29, then Israel set men in ambush all around Gibeah, and the children of Israel went up against the children of Benjamin on the third day and put themselves in battle array against Gibeah, as at other times. So the children of Benjamin went out against the people, were drawn away from the city. They began to strike down and kill some of the people, as at other times in the highways, one which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the field about 30 men of Israel. So God wasn't even done yet. Some of the Israelites still died in that battle, not near as many. Again, God knows the heart, doesn't he? He knows the plan and the purpose. So there's a lot of information that's not filled in here, but there were still some issues no doubt, even with some of the men of Israel that still thought it in their heart maybe to do their own vengeance. When God says, vengeance is mine, he said, I will repay, didn't they? But there was obviously a problem with Benjamin that God was going to take, deal with. Verse 33, all of the men of Israel rose from their place and put themselves in battle array at Baal Tamar, and Israel's men in ambush burst forth from their position in the plain of Geba. And 10,000 select men from all Israel came against Gibeah, and the battle was fierce. But the Benjamites did not know that disaster was upon them. The Lord defeated Benjamin. Who did? Did the Israelites? No, it says the Lord did. He's the one that gave them the strength. They had already lost about 40,000 plus men in battle. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites. Okay, if you take that number, 25,000, and you look back at verse 15, 26,000 men, and they lost 25,100, and more to come. Basically, the men were wiped out. So the children of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel had given ground to the Benjamites because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. And the men in ambush quickly rushed upon Gibeah. The men in ambush spread out and struck the whole city with the edge of the sword. Now the appointed signal between the men of Israel and the men in ambush was that they would make a great cloud of smoke rise up from the city, whereupon the men of Israel would turn in battle. Now Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 of the men of Israel, for they said, surely they are defeated before us, as in the first battle. But when the cloud began to rise from the city in the column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and there was the whole city going up to smoke in heaven. And when the men of Israel turned back, the Benjamites panicked, for they saw that disaster had come upon them. Therefore they turned their backs before the men of Israel in the direction of the wilderness. But the battle overtook them, and whoever had come out of the cities they destroyed in their midst. They surrounded the Benjamites and chased them, and easily trampled them down as far as the front of the Gibeah toward the east. And 18,000 men of Benjamin fell. All these were men of valor. And they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon, and they cut down 5,000 of them on the highways. And they pursued them relentlessly up to Gideon and killed 2,000 of them. So all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of valor. But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness and the rock of Rimmon, and they stayed at the rock of Rimmon for 4 months. And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with every edge of the sword from every city, men and beasts, all who were found. And they also set fires to all the cities they came to. This was a horrendous thing that took place out of one incident. And it was an awful incident, but it about cost Benjamin its tribe. Some of us can only remember that in likes of what our country went through and what we remember to be the Civil War and the awful things that took place then, the divisions, the deaths that took place, and what was a Civil War. Israel is now poised to just about lose one of their tribes, and now you can see an attitude changing here. Verse chapter 21, it says, now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, none of us will give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. Again, a very foolish oath that was sworn, wasn't it? Once again, there's a reason for this taking place. And the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and they wept bitterly and said, O God of Israel, why is this come to pass in Israel that today there should be one tribe missing in Israel? So it was on the next morning that the people rose early and built an altar and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with us to the assembly of the Lord? For they made a great oath concerning anyone who did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah, saying, he sure shall surely be put to death. Now more were going to be killed because of a foolish oath. And the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin their brother, and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them our daughters as wives? And they said, what one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Lord, and in fact, no one had come up to the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. So for whatever reason, they did not come after they were commanded to come and help fight against the Benjamites. For when the people were counted, indeed not one of those was from Jabesh-Gilead were there. So the congregation sent out their 12,000 of their most valiant men and commanded them, saying, "Go strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, including the women and children. This is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately." So they found it upon the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp of Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan. This kind of foregoes dating, doesn't it, when you see this? I mean, there's the women, here you go. So notice how the picture was much different in the culture many, many years ago. So Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them all the women whom they had saved alive, the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them. And the people grieved for Benjamin, because the Lord had made a void in the tribes of Israel. And the elders of the congregation said, "What shall we do for the wives who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" Don't forget, they went to the city and they wiped out about everybody, including the women as well. They said, "There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that the tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, 'Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin.'" It's so interesting that they could count that so important. It doesn't matter that we wipe everybody out, kill all the women, but we got to stick to our oath. Very unusual how they looked at things, and rightly so when you see, again, the conclusion of this. They said, "In fact, there's a yearly feast of the Lord in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, 'Go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch. And just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, come out from the vineyards, and every man can catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh.'" There's your dating. Go grab one. I mean, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? When you look back, this obviously is a testimony, really did happen. I don't think any one of the women would have wanted to be back at that time. "Then it will be when their fathers or their brothers come us to complain that we'll say, 'Be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it's not as though you have given us the young woman at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath.' So the children of Benjamin did so. They took themselves enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every one to his tribe and family, and there they went out from there, every man to his own inheritance." And here's this small little scripture that sums it up. This is the conclusion of the whole matter. "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Welcome to the 21st century. You think anything's new. And that might not be the women, but you'll find some of the same attitudes out of those testimonies that you still have there. In fact, there are more testimonies in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's go here. 1 Samuel chapter 8. "Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." And sometimes I like to think about this and bring this up because we can see a lot of wrong things that transpire around us. And we're not thinking and going up to God and asking Him, "What do you think? Make sure my heart is right before you, though I see all these wrong things, I can handle them in a way that's representative of God and Jesus Christ. That I can be humbled and say, 'You know something? For a broken spirit is, God, I'm nothing. I can see this, but I know that you are the God of this world and the God of this age right now. Nothing happens without you seeing it.'" 1 Samuel 18, such an incredible thing happens here that you find it's come up all the way to our day and age today. I would say right around 1776, at least then. So you see a time here in 1 Samuel chapter 8 that something was going wrong. And it wasn't as if the king wasn't there, but they had a prophet. A prophet chosen of God. His name is Samuel. You can go back and see how Samuel was used by God to give God's word and God's will to the other kings as well, to Saul and to David. And now you've got a problem because Samuel got old. It says that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba, but his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and they perverted justice. Okay, there's no doubt that they did this, right? I mean, this is the truth. How was this handled? All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said, "Look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations." Remember what God already instructed them? Don't go after, don't do what the other nations had done. God had given them the law. They knew what it was. So what happens here? The thing displeased Samuel. "Give us a king to judge us." So Samuel prayed to God. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them." Now, according to the facts here that you see in the scripture, you would not necessarily come to that conclusion. You and I would go, the kids were bad. They're perverting judgment. That's kind of a no-brainer. They go. There's got to be something we can do. And since Samuel is getting old, well, it works for the other nations. They have kings and everything seems to be going well. Can you see all of a sudden this mindset taking place? They didn't want to follow God's laws because of verse 8. "According to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, which with they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also." It was no different. "However, you shall warn them." And so, you get, beginning in verse 11, he's saying, this is what's going to happen with the king. He's going to take your chariots. He's going to tax you like crazy. He's going to make it pretty miserable for you. I mean, it was all laid out here, and they still chose it. You would think, come on, really? He's going to take a tenth of your grain. He's going to take a tenth of your sheep. And in verse 18, it says, "And you will cry out in that day because of the king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day." So they refused. And God said, "Give him a king." Now, we can see what happened in those days when you get your Sauls and you got your, even your Davids and you got your Solomons. And you see, even if you remember Rehoboam, he was taught, hey, go easy, go easy. I'm going to double down on these people. You know, then you think Solomon, I always thought, well, Solomon, you know, after David, seemed to be a pretty good king, wrote the words of wisdom, was pretty smart. But God even told him, don't multiply for yourselves women, because they're going to take you away. And it's exactly what happened. And it's not pointed out there, but I've always pointed out that, by the way, don't forget, he took all the good women, didn't he? I mean, if there was a good woman out there, she's mine, she's mine. How many of the men of Israel hated him? Because it's almost like, you know, one's not good for him enough. He had to take the one that I was looking at, the one I was close to. There were probably a lot that wanted to kill him. So he did not necessarily do it right. So we saw, God said, this is what's going to happen. And you know what is ironic about it? Read, since we're coming up on July 4th, read the Declaration of Independence. Why'd they come over here? Because of the king. He's taken our land. He's doing all the things that you see here. Even the king of England was doing that. And that's what they wrote down. It's like a testimony of 1 Samuel chapter 8. This is what God, the king was oppressive. So they come over here writing the Declaration of Independence. Was I look at as a reminder of this. Why don't we just follow God? It just doesn't happen. Everyone does what's right in his own eyes. Today, you have in this world, everyone does it right in their own eyes. And what's happened to the church? For years, I've seen what's happened in the church. All the blame goes on someone else. Instead of looking at, God be merciful to me, I'm a nobody. I look to you. I look to you, Jesus Christ, as the head of the church. But no, we've got to find somebody that's going to write all the accounts of the sins that are taking place at somebody's headquarters. They do this, and they do this, and they make it miserable for everybody else. How about you? What about you? Is there ever God be merciful to me? Jesus Christ, you're the head of the church. You know how to deal with this. You know how to handle it. I want to make sure that even though I see some things that may be wrong, that I handle it appropriately in your eyes, and I don't do what these people did. You'll find the same thing in Numbers chapter 12. Let's go back to Numbers chapter 12. Everyone feels justified. Now, I see what's happening today, even in our society. I've mentioned it's very difficult to watch more than 15 minutes of the news today. When you see the hatred and everything else sometimes, but what happens is that attitude can creep over into us. When God is saying, by the way, I want to let you know here, I got everything under control. Well, you know, people will go, well, if he has so much control, how'd this guy get in? How do you think? He knows exactly what he's doing. He sees the direction of this country. The lessons that we learned from Daniel, and even the king at that time, Nebuchadnezzar, who says, you know, what I found, because God can make a king eat grass. And he said, what I learned out of that, it's God who rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to the basis. And that was thousands of years ago. And the same thing happens today. But now you kind of get, not only in our country, and everybody kind of up for himself, and it's the same thing that can squeak through into the church. Because I've seen this and because I've seen that, I can be the one now to determine where the feast is or not do this and determine that I'm going to keep the Sabbath at home for where three or more that are gathered in my name, totally misrepresenting the scripture because that's not what it's talking about in church attendance. And so this is what I've seen today. Maybe you've seen the same thing. It's a good time with the spirit that God's given to us to refocus and look and see where we stand because the times are getting so much worse. In Numbers chapter 12, verse 1, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, has the Lord, all of a sudden they get this, well, I'm seeing this, this is not looking too good here. I don't think he should have done this. And God ends up saying, you know something? It's none of your business. Pretty much did that. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all who are on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So they came out. The Lord came down to the pillar of the cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. And he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream, but not even with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak plainly with him face to face, not in dark sayings. And he saw the form of the Lord. Remember, as God, Moses even said, can I see you? And he saw his hind parts as God put him in the cleft, and God spoke about that. Why were you then not even afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And again, you can see what happened eventually within that. Once again, the testimonies of God as sometimes hard to even read as they are. That wasn't an easy thing to read when you go back to the book of Judges and you saw what took place with that woman, the dealings that took place, but it's still there as a testimony. Even for us today, that's not written. Go, by the way, you don't have to read that anymore. There was something that was wrong there, and there's an attitude that pervades and carries over. I know I don't want to have that attitude. I don't want to ever get into that mode where I can constantly look around me and see so many wrong things that are happening that I forget to look in the mirror at this guy and saying, God, I don't deserve to be here. I am grateful that you have called me. It's a wonderful thing that's been done. And we're preparing for something so much different. And that attitude can creep in so unexpectedly when we keep looking at the negative things. And you find yourself sometimes getting either so mad are so aggravated that all the fingers start to point, as it's happening within this world. And it's hard not to get caught up with it when people are so surrounded with it. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2. I thought we had a clock in here at one point, but I've got my... Okay. 2 Peter chapter 2. Verse 1, 2 Peter 2, verse 1, but there were also false prophets among the people, even as there will be false teachers among you, who will secretly bring in destructive heresies, even denying the Lord who bought them, and bring on themselves swift destruction. And many will follow their destructive ways, because of whom the way of truth will be blasphemed. Now, I kind of think we've already, in one sense, went through a big one with that, for those that have been around for 20, 30 years. It's not over yet. There will be still more deceptions if people aren't reading their Bibles and, again, as Mr. Dean said, making sure that their foundations are secure. It's very easy for Satan to climb in and start whittling away at that. By covetousness, they will exploit you with deceptive words. For a long time, their judgment has not been idle, and their destruction does not slumber. So you can see, again, this brings it up to the future time when we've got to be watching, being so careful and cautious. Again, one of the most wonderful things I think that can happen is within the fellowship of the people when we can talk about these things. See what's happening around us. Put ourselves into check to see what our attitudes are and where they stand and where we stand before God. Such a special time on God's Sabbath day. And a time, again, as we had for the weekend, I don't think we get enough sometimes. I appreciate the times that we can get together for a Sabbath day, but it's so short. One day, one partial day, we can get together, and then you've got 6 weeks you go back out with this mentality of I, me, 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 and you recognize who's behind it. You see, Satan the devil stirs that up. He's still out there. The demons are still out there stirring up these kind of attitudes. And we've got to put ourselves in checks, realizing that that can drift in into our lives as well. You know, in any Bible program such as eSword will most likely come up blank when you look at this caption of something that's called an attitude. In Strong's Comprehensive Concordance, you'll reach the word attired before coming on the word audience. Those are the only words. There is nothing that relates to attitude, but it's throughout the Bible. So interesting, a word that's not even mentioned. But there are words that are like it in comparison that I'd like to go to a couple of scriptures today. See, there were times, if you remember, especially as a child, but everybody here was told that they had a bad attitude. Well, you've got a bad attitude. You know what's even harder? Is when you don't feel like you've got a bad attitude and you're told that you've got a bad attitude. It comes at you so much. I remember saying one time somebody accusing of a bad attitude. Go, you know, I played hockey most of my life and I never hit somebody. I would get them in a headlock so they wouldn't hit me. But I'm kind of going, you don't understand, because if I really had a bad attitude, you'd probably be on the floor right now. That would be a bad attitude. Maybe it was that you were red in the face, and maybe you've done a good job really with that. You know what really tests your attitude is when you have a good attitude and you're told you've got a bad one. That really tests the boat, doesn't it? That really tests the foundation. It's very difficult. But again, that should kind of ignite us to go back to God and go, God, you're the judge. You know my heart. If there's something wrong within my attitude, then please guide me and help me through your Holy Spirit. There may be some that judges you wrong, or maybe they may have a point there. But we can define this word called attitude, and there's an interesting thing. The synonyms reveal a lot about this, because it speaks of an air or approach, an attitude, maybe even a belief towards something, a bias towards something, a demeanor. What kind of demeanor? How are they coming across to them. Sometimes some can sense what's called what? We call it vibes. You just will be talking to somebody and going, I'm not really feeling a good air or demeanor from this person. You might sense that they're angry, or we've got these little things called chip on one's shoulder. Somebody's got a chip on their shoulder. It could be a perspective. Attitude could even be a point of view on something that we're always involved with because we're always discussing what our air or our view is about so many things, how we look upon things. Our reaction sometimes, our sentiment, our temperament, our view, or I call, what's your twist on this? What's your bias on that? You see, all these are synonyms for attitude. They're typically related to liking or disliking something, even with a positive or negative mentality. They're more than personality traits, but they've got to do with temperament. We can start by going back to an example, again, a testimony for us, back in Genesis chapter 4. And once again, we're going to see that there's a lot of details that are left out. Sometimes we wonder, there's been a lot of guesses on wondering what Cain's offering, what happened, what was the problem. But in Hebrews, it speaks about that, doesn't it? It said Abel's offering was more presentable and accepted by God, so there was something wrong. Maybe it was attitude, maybe it was the offering itself, but there was a problem with attitude. Genesis 4, verse 1, Adam knew Eve, his wife. She conceived and bore Cain and said, I've gotten a man from the Lord. And she bore his brother Abel. And Abel was the keeper of sheep, but Cain was the tiller of the ground. That's why the guest went in. Was it supposed to be a sin offering? Was it supposed to be an animal? Because Cain brought, but it doesn't say. So that's not the point here. The point is what happened with Cain. The process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to the Lord. You go, well, that sounds okay. So you do get the first recorded information concerning offerings. Isn't that something? It doesn't really say there was no written down law of offerings, but you know that they were taught about offerings. Here you get that first record concerning that. And Abel, he brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof, but and the Lord had respect to Abel and his offering, but to Cain and his offering, he did not have respect. Again, we don't know if it was the type or even sometimes as we present the offering. See, if someone, say, if you bring $100 for an offering and I bring 10, but you don't bring yours in thankfulness to God, you bring it because I got to bring an offering. And I bring $10 and I'm going, thank you, God, I can't give you enough. Who does God's respect go to for the offering? It's not the amount. So it's a possibility here that Cain thought, well, I got to bring this. So maybe it wasn't the best either. Now, how some would bring they'll look around. Remember I said before that as Passover approached on the 10th of the month, they picked out a sheep. And what an example it would be for a father to take his kids out, go, guess what? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to find the best sheep here to give to God. Now, wouldn't that be something to teach that to your children? To God goes the best. And they're out looking and go, hey, Dad, over here, I think I got one here. And the other child goes, well, let's bring them together here. And you go through that process. Would God be so pleased with that? What kind of attitude is expressed in something like that? All we know is Cain's offering, he did not have respect, and Cain was angry, and his countenance fell. He was angry, and he got a chip. Look, I brought an offering. I brought what was presented. I brought what I was told to do. Once again, there's a lot more to this than is written sometimes. We don't know exactly, except that he developed what's called, he was the first one, well, not actually, he was the first physical human being, in that sense, you could say, that got a BA. The bad attitude. And he asked, God said, verse 6, why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, Sin lies at the door, and unto you will be its desire, and you will rule over it. Cain talked with his brother, came to pass. When they were in the field, Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and killed him. It festered so bad. The attitude festered so bad. And that's what's happened over time. You know what's so sad about that? The insanity that's going on in the into this world. When you see countries, I look at some of the news briefs on a country, say, such as North Korea or something. I'm going, this is insanity. And I can't do anything about it. But I see insanity within our country as well. But I'm going, these are now not just people, entire nations that want to kill and destroy each other. This is crazy. And this is the mentality of so many countries, the insanity that's taking place. And then it festers right within our country as well. How many, again, remember disobeying their parents' instruction, receiving correction, and having their countenance fall, getting into a bad attitude because they didn't believe that it was fair? There was a Kids for Character some years ago when we were instructing our kids. I remember that. There was a song that I can't remember. I've got to get that song. It's not fair, it's not fair, it's not fair. It's not F-A-I-R, fair. He wants red, she wants blue. And it kind of wants a song like that that kind of made you crack up because you saw what starts within our children. And if that's nipped in the bud, maybe some of you had parents or grandparents whose countenances fell so easy because they just were never trained on dealing with attitudes. Well, I don't know about that. There was always some kind of comment about something that would pop out. Well, I don't know about that. I don't know about that guy over there. Or something is not fair. God is the God of justice. He will make things fair. So having said that, it won't be difficult to proceed through some of the scriptures to discover many other countenances that fell, some rather ungodly or, yes, very bad attitudes. You see, before the creation of mankind, one can find a bad attitude that developed. Wasn't that interesting? How could you be around the throne of God and develop a bad attitude? You know, when you think about it, the same thing actually happened that I just read to you in the book of Judges. Because they saw something and decided to take it upon themselves. Saying, I can do this a little better. Satan obviously decided that some things where he was weren't fair. And yet he was at the very throne of God. Something festered, didn't it? Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel 28. Now once again, here for testimonies to show that these things happen. And maybe you won't get like it was with Satan. But I would kind of like to check it and head it off at the pass. I believe with foundations, little cracks will start. And then what happens, the water starts to seep through that crack, and it'll widen it and continue to open it, and it will fester and get a lot bigger until you've got a major problem. I know that little bit about foundations anyway, that they start. And if you can nip them in the bud when they first start, you can prevent something major from occurring. And it's really the same thing within our lives. If we catch it early, and if we can think, you know, and that's why I've mentioned many times, because I see this coming at God's people. It's very difficult to watch the news and just, I'm amazed. I'm constantly amazed at the hostility, at the attitude. You would think that more people would want to come together. Let's do this. We're one nation under God. But see, when God is left out, it's kind of a natural, isn't it? It's going to happen. When people push God away, you can see all of a sudden people will justify lying, even to our highest political officials. And I don't always know what the truth is on any given thing, but I kind of watch attitudes. See how things are going. What's happening? But I can only take a little bit of that, catch up on it a little bit, and then maybe go to God and go, God, and pray for our, what does the Bible say? Pray for our leaders, that we may live peaceable lives. That's what our responsibility is, not to go around going, well, you know what happened over there, and that one happened over there, especially when we don't have all the facts. We can think that we do. But sometimes I don't know what they all are. What are you going to get at? Which news media are you going to get truth from? So many times we see it's all kind of slanted in a way, some more than others, but what really is the truth? Ezekiel chapter 28. Obviously, Satan got wind, and this attitude spread to a third of the angels. We know that what took place. It was an attitude that was stirred up. Now, what we don't know, again, in detail, is there was another two-thirds of the angels. I think they all, I believe, again, but it doesn't say, I believe that they all got a fair shot, that they were all presented with us, and a third decided to side with Satan. Let the attitude fester. So it happened within a spiritual, angelic realm that God gave the ability to choose. They made a choice. So what can happen around us? We've got a nation of people that this attitude starts to get stirred up. And I tell you what, there are people that hate. It's the hatred that gets me, not just the disagreement, but the vile hatred that people get. And I go back at that going, there's an appropriateness in being able to discuss certain things. I remember one of the senators spoke about this. He goes, you know, we used to be able to sit on two sides of the aisle and you could even strongly disagree. And then you would go out to lunch with each other. You were still friends, even though that you were on, they call it, opposite sides of the aisle. And you're not finding that. You're finding people are nearly coming to blows now within our very own country. It's a very sad thing to see. And if you and I can watch and see what's happening, then we've got to be very cautious. Because there's a lot of attitudes stirring up on social media today, and some of the brethren are getting caught up in that. And getting caught up in things that they don't fully understand or don't fully understand all the facts that are going on and taking place. It's very discouraging sometimes. Verse 2 of Ezekiel 28. Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord God, because your heart is lifted up, and you say, I am a god, I sit in the seat of gods in the midst of the seas, yet you're a man and not a god. Though you set your heart as the heart of a god. Once again, we go back and in thy loving kindness, Lord, we ask God for his forgiveness. But then we can point the finger to everyone else and say, what does God expect in that song that we sing? For a broken, contrite heart. That's what God is looking at, is looking for. Verse 5, by your great wisdom and trade, you have increased your riches, and your heart is lifted up because of your riches. It's very difficult when all of a sudden things are going well in your lives, and you've got enough, and you've got the money. Very difficult to not start to get ahead of yourself because I'm all provided for. I'm taken care of. It's something, again, that we need to put ourselves in check. Again, in this country, we've got so much abundance. Now, how much do we thank God for, even really when we, anytime we eat somewhat of a meal? And we've got brethren on the other side of the world that have to seek every day just to find their food. It's a wonderful example if some of our young ones can go, or if you've had the opportunity to travel and go overseas, sometimes at feast sites. You know, you go to certain feast sites and go, wow, they don't have a lot of what we have over here. We're used to a nice steak or something. You have to go to other places where you have to pay extra for that. As Dr. Levy had mentioned, we went to China, and I lost 15 pounds because it was very difficult to put bean curd down in the morning. Yet it was probably pretty good for you. I imagine that, or a big carp. Fish is good, and that carp was actually clean. But I grew up where it was living in canals, and it stunk. And I never wanted to eat a carp. I guess if I was hungry enough, I probably would. But I guess I wasn't hungry enough at that time to eat it, so I lost 15 pounds. But we are so blessed, and when you see that over there, when you see the scrawny chicken that they've got, or someplace else that you go, they just don't have a lot. How much are we really thankful, or do we take that for granted, that we can get a basic of whatever we want, almost whenever we want, in all types? Verse 17, here it says, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. So I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. Satan is going to become nothing. Though he still deceives himself into thinking that he's something. In fact, the deception is so great that even as I can speak about it today, he doesn't believe it. He thinks he will be able to overcome. That's where the deception, and something happens within the mindset that it's just, you lose it. And people don't think the way that they're supposed to think. That deception goes in many forms. Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14 is this other description of him that gives a little bit more to the detail here. And again, what we have to realize, toward the time of the end, God said that he will come at you harder. For God's people, remember, if he can take you and I down as first fruits, he's made a great score. The others, it's easy. They've already been deceived. But how about taking down first fruit? Or, how about taking down a nation? As we know, the descendants of the Israelites, how about taking them down again? Make them discount God. He's working very hard. Verse 11, your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the sound of your stringed instruments, the maggot is spread unto you, and worms cover you. How are you fallen from heaven? Pretty descriptive, isn't it? That's how God looks upon his attitude. Like maggots. It's horrible. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you said in your heart, I'll ascend into heaven. I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregations on the farthest side of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. You're going to be brought down to nothing. And it's, people are going to be astonished when this being is finally put out, finally put down. Do you know, for those of us that are watching it, it's a great joy and a great victory when that comes to pass, and yet we're still going to have to deal with the extra that comes along. I've heard many different notions and ideas on what will take place in the millennial reign, that even though that Satan will be bound, that we'll still have to teach, again, people that have been so in tune and trained within their mind with the wrong type of attitudes and the wrong type of thinking. They're going to have to now think the way that God thinks, and maybe they're going to wonder, well, why do it that way? I think we could do it that way. By that time, by the way, we will already have become first fruits with our character set. We will know that we're going to listen to God and the way he does it. Maybe we'll say that to somebody, because I've learned over the years, over my life, that when God says to do it this way, even though I may not understand it, that that's the way to do it. I might have gone through it. I've seen deaths in my family, or young people being killed, or pastors before their time, and go, you know something? It's a very sad thing, and I'm not sure why, but I know God knows exactly what he's doing. And I know what I have to do is pray for these people, pray for the brethren that have taken such heavy losses, knowing it's difficult, for God to keep their countenance uplifted, and that we will never doubt God. And in your minds, every one of us here, we will always say, you know, I don't care what, it doesn't matter, because I know that God's in control of everything. Some things are hurtful, I don't understand why, but I will never doubt God. It's not even in my mind to ever do that. So God, you do what you're going to do, but help me, because I'm nothing. And that's why I need his help so much. Ephesians chapter 2. Let's finish here today, Ephesians chapter 2. But something to consider, again, we just went through a wonderful special time that God has made a feast called a Feast of First Fruits. That's God's feast, but it's ours. It really is ours. It's called the Feast of Harvest or the Feast of First Fruits because it deals specifically with the first harvest. And again, we recognize that that's going to be connected with the end time full harvest, that there will be others that God will call in the future as well. But that's ours. But it's also for us to know that we never deserved it, we don't deserve it, and there's something that we always need to do that the scriptures say, as in 1 Peter, you're the kings and priests, but I require something from you. I require a higher standard, just as God did with Israel. I brought you out to be an example to all the nations around you, not to become like them, which they did, to always be an example. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1, and you, he has quickened, he has made alive who were dead, not physically, who were dead in trespasses and sins. Where in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience, of whom we also had our conduct in times past in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, just like others. It started with attitudes. It started when we were real young, having bad attitudes. And unless your parents or your grandparents or someone else bred that out of you by replacing it with the way that God thinks, and that's why we teach our children. That's why it's important not just to tell your child, you got a bad attitude, but to sit down and go through what's wrong with that and teaching them about putting on the nature of God, not just by putting that out. Remember, the days of unleavened bread were before that putting it out, and that we replace it with something good. Then you recognize, I can't do that without God. You can't. It's not possible to have that attitude that God desires without what Christ said would become the comforter, the one that would make it possible, the power that would make it possible for us to think in a way that pleases God. So if we can remember that as we go through this summer, and as we pray again for the ones that have lost loved ones, and pray for the camps, and pray for each other, because it all has to do with focusing in on what God wants. By the way, it's really a major caption for camps is no doubt fun. But if you remember what we're talking about this year with our campers, it has to do with vision. We're trying to convey to them what God wants us to see. And it says, vision, seeing clearly what? In a clouded world. I only have 3 days to do that. But it's so interesting what the Spirit of God, what 3 days can do with young minds. How they'll always remember it. Yes, they had fun, but there was a concept that we're giving them that eventually there will be teens and they'll be members of the church and they'll be married and have their own kids. And maybe they can focus and go, I remember years ago when I was at that camp. Because I can remember my first time at camp. And maybe I developed a bit of a bad attitude, but I got over it. Because you couldn't eat food in bed at night. So then you would get swats for it. But you know something? I can look back at that and say, I had a great camp. Because it was just a small part of it. That I saw, maybe I wouldn't do it that way. Maybe I wouldn't do it this way. And I saw that there were different administrations. You'd see it within different pastors. Some here would say, well, I wouldn't do it that way. I like the way that he did it. I'm not him. And you're not that other person. We all come together with different attitudes sometimes that have been challenged. We have to see, how does God want this to work? How does he want us to operate? So whatever we do, or whatever we think can be pleasing in his sight. Let's do a check on that. We don't want to be graduates with a degree of a BA. Let's think of the other graduation, where we have God's Spirit, and we graduate with that degree, and helping others with their certificate of the GA, or the good attitude. Have a wonderful week. Let's see through this clouded world with the vision of wonderful Spirit of God and great attitudes.